Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Good morning and welcome to Guardian Radio AM. I am Catherine Chisnell Mitchell and I'm thrilled to be here today for what is turning out to be another edition of Bahamian Authors Book Club Fridays. This is my latest pitch to my good friend, Sian Nuri, who along with Guardian Radio, I thank for allowing conversations that encourage us to grapple with issues within our country with visceral honesty and insight. We need you to call in to make this show exciting today. We want to hear what you have to say. We want your thoughts and feelings and notes. Our telephone numbers are 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259, and I think it's coming in from the Family Islands. Is it 300-5720? Our text line, powered by BTC, is 422-GR96. That's 422-4796. I'm thrilled to be in the studio today to be, again, discussing the issues in our headlines that somehow, without question, take root in our homes. And in the Bahamian the Bahamian homestead is where societal sickness can start, but also more importantly, is where strengths and solutions lie. Before I get into the meat or the heart of the show, I just have to take a moment, and everyone in the studio who has shared this experience with me, to give a shout out to our wonderful Bahamian playwright, Gia Pierre. I finally got off my tail and organized myself to go see her sensational piece, March On, which has been to Nassau, Bahamas before. It comes out of Grand Bahama with a Grand Bahama talented crew, but it came back to Nassau, Bahamas and was at UB last weekend. On Saturday night, I went out with my mother, my niece, my sister, my brother-in-law, and witnessed something that I think that was really important and moving. There was a talented cast that led this story from the eve of our independence up until modern times, and it was heartfelt, it was moving. I snot laughed and cried. I felt inspired and uplifted, but I also felt that it was an honest look at who we are and where we are as a people. And though it covered darker issues and times within our history, it left me feeling hopeful. It left me looking forward to the light that we're marching towards, we're marching on with. And for those of us listening, and I think that's a good majority of our audience, we are planning to be born here and dead here in the Bahamas. This is where our bones will die. But we want to continue to build upon the structures laid before us. In the play March On, it talks about honoring those that came behind, that created the path, that prepared the way. And now it's up to us, the generation still standing on our good two feet, to walk down that path. I encourage you, because I texted her this morning and told her I was going to talk good about her play on the radio. I think she talked to Dwight before, so I'm in theme, but I just want to, I think it deserves a nod of Bahamian praise, because it's not so much a promotion for ticket sales, it's to say this talent exists in our country. This storytelling exists in our country. This is something we need to curate as a cultural export, and I encourage you, when the play returns in mid-June, to really make an effort to get a ticket and get yourself there. You will be proud of that, what you see, and a shout out to the cast that it was an endurance feat. A multi-generational cast and a multi-generational audience all received this play as a gift, and I just was beyond touched by it all. So I had to begin with that because I thought it was moving, and I encourage anyone who has the opportunity to get out and see the play upon its return and also know that within our country exists great talent. And I, again, thank Guardian Radio for continuing to make space for us to talk about that. We are in the studio today with a newly published Bahamian author. This year marks 4 years since the declaration of the COVID pandemic, a time web with challenges, with a country still rebuilding from the Dorian destruction. We're used to seasonal knockouts in this paradise living. We know what could happen when hurricane season comes around. But just knowing that the threat, each season brings a threat of a hurricane doesn't lessen its inevitable winds of damage when they come. The last few years have created extreme levels of stress on families and individuals around us, leading to some breakdowns, leading to some trauma. Daily in headlines, we can see this coming up. And in some cases, leading to the horror that is divorce. With divorce, our author today writes, no area of life is untouched. It can ripple or roar across an entire community, affecting generations, leaving pain, embarrassment, and disunity in its wake. Children mourn, parents rage, friends and siblings are traumatized and confused. All memories are changed forever. All memories can be tainted. And for women in our Western culture, their name may not even be their own anymore. But despite this acknowledgement, the book that we're going to talk about today, which is called Weathering the Hurricane of Divorce, Reflections of a Survivor, it's filled with light. It's filled with hope. It's filled with the not the promise of rebuilding, but the signposts that can lead to you choosing a path forward, to marching on in your own life, if you will, in a way that is positive and healing for a community. Now, though this is written by a young woman, this conversation does not have to only be woman-based. If you're a man who has something that you'd like to ask or add to this conversation, we'd love your input, your insight, and your wisdom when it comes to this area. Our author today was raised with all the island brought-upsy that would make us proud. Homestead in Gambier, a mango farm childhood with families, the Malis family out at Adelaide. She was a QC Comet that bleeds white and green, the captain of our softball team at high school, head girl, the top graduate of Hellenic College outside of Boston in religious studies. I think she were valedictorian. Vibrantly involved in family life ministries of her Orthodox church for decades. Law firm office manager and schooled in the fields of anti-money laundering compliance. And a Bahamian community believer. This is a woman who's always PTA president, always president of something and doing something. Gyro slinging at Greek festivals. I call her our community emergency first responder. When anything happens, when Ramphilly got hit with Dorian also, and we were told to make room for all of the dozens of incoming children from Grand Bahama, she was my first phone call. And I knew that within 24 hours, we would have a dorm up and running. And this lady left her own family, shout out to you family for surviving, to make sure that these children were taken care of. So this is the kind of human that this book is coming from. She also happens to be my big sister. And with that knowledge, I know that she's a woman of great grace and generous conduct. Generous and with impeccable bearing. And so I'm proud to welcome my sister, Callie Opie Kushel Wilson, into the studio today, accompanied by her lovely daughter, who has also been mentored by the C.A. Nuri Show and has taken her skill set off into university now. She has just completed her first semester and a half at the Savannah College of Art and Design and is returning to us with straight A's and with a different side of what happens a decade after a divorce story. 10 years ago, Callie faced a crisis when her family, coming out of the global financial darkness that was around circa 2008, I believe, she said in her book, she thought she saw a light at the tunnel, but really it was another train coming. Now, I'm going to go ahead and hand this over to her. My sister is pretending to be nervous, but she's verbally blessed. And she also is a deeply private and conservative person. So I have to start by asking her, why did you write this book, which is a deeply personal account, and why is it important that you write it now?
I ask myself that every day, especially at about 2 a.m. in the morning when I can't sleep. And I hope that my family forgives me for anything I overshared at any point. But I found myself, it's actually now 15 years past the divorce.
We're getting old.
Time is moving fast. But I found myself in church ministries and just with friends and family that were going through similar challenges to what I had faced in the past, having the same conversation over and over. You know, someone would come to me and say, will you please speak to my daughter? She's going through a divorce. What do you think could help her? And I would literally end up offering the same comfort as a cancer survivor would talk to someone who was struggling with a cancer diagnosis or going through chemo. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a therapist. just a fellow survivor that can hopefully offer some comfort, because it's very isolating. You feel like you're the only one going through something like this and that no one really understands it. So this was just a conversation for those who are hurting. And it's not just for someone in the immediate aftermath of a divorce. It's, as I said, there are family members that bear scar from divorce. And there are many different types of heartache that this can apply to. What, you know, losing a best friend, losing a child, losing any challenge we face in life. It's just there was not a lot that I found of this type of conversation, especially in our lovely, beloved Orthodox Church. There was nothing that was a first-person account of survival and reflection, and I found that that was really important. And also, COVID lockdown, for all of its evils and challenges, actually gave me the time at home to write it, which I would have never got between work and family without it.
Because I couldn't have done it. I talk about a lot of things a lot of the time, but when it comes to opening up personally, it makes you feel very vulnerable. But I think anybody that has experienced professional help, and you've said you're not a professional, and you've said that you understand that every issue of divorce, loss, separation, and trauma are unique to the individuals and their circumstances. You say that throughout the book, but you hope by opening up, by sharing a story and some vulnerabilities, you may offer comfort to those struggling with the ramifications of this divorce. A reminder that they're not alone and that it is possible to weather this storm. And needless to say, we can see in the death, the suicides, the sadnesses in our paper on a daily basis that the home is lost in storms. A lot of our Bahamian homes are in the midst of their own hurricanes. Why did you choose the metaphor of a hurricane?
I think as a Bahamian, it's something we've all experienced. The destruction, the helplessness, whatever may have happened before a divorce, leading to a divorce, once the ball gets rolling and you might see the storm approaching or it might turn into a Category 5 overnight, it doesn't matter. It's just, it will destroy anything. And also you're left with that indecision of how to respond to the storm. You don't know whether you should stay in your house or go to a different shelter. You don't know whether to prioritize your children's safety or if maybe I stayed in my house and plugged the one little leak that was coming through that I would still have a roof over my children's heads. It's that kind of level. And also the strength I think we have as a Bahamian people, that we get hit over and over again and we know how to rebuild. We know how to regroup. Of course, there's always casualties and we're very aware of that. There's nothing more annoying I found when someone said to me in the heat of the storm, it'll be okay. You're going to be all right. Because in my head, all I thought is, how do you know that? There's no guarantee. We see people that end up in Fox Hill or Sandilands dealing with something like this. And so at the same time, there's that residual strength. So I went back to the basics of my faith, of coping mechanisms. And I just wanted to put that out there. So I also didn't have to hold on to all of this for someone who might need it in the future, and that was in a format that was available.
So you felt like you had to stoop and rebuild with worn-out tools to keep quoting Rudyard Kipling's If, as we started the conversation on our literary loves last week, and you felt that these tools were something that would be important to share. I enjoyed the I think that we have a hurricane culture in that, as you said, we do understand as a people what it means to prepare, what it means to not be prepared, what it means to look after Hurricane Matthew as I stood on the shores of our mango farm at Adelaide and saw the heaps of dead trees and soaking homes and houses and people completely washed out, to think there is no recovery. And now we're years later. And I aged the hurricane with my children because I had my son in his little diaper wandering around in puddles. And now I see that he's grown and the trees have regrown. And so I think we get that. And as you said, we have a certain resilience as a people. Hurricanes have almost forced us to be out of the box thinkers, because we know that we have to take what we have and make the most of it. So I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Maria, as you sit here and reread and hear your mother speaking, we're standing at the other side of a journey. You we've begun at the beginning of the journey of the destruction. Callie had to relocate back from the States to the Bahamas to start a new career, to rebuild a homestead. She had two young children that were 4 and 5 at the time. You were that 4 and 5-year-old child that was taken from the only home you'd known and relocated. You're now a proud Bahamian that stands here, another Queens College graduate that have gone off. As you hear your mom talk at the beginning of this conversation, is there anything that comes up for you?
Mainly how proud I am of how far we have come, especially when I got to read the draft of the book. I was shaken by how many memories I had forgotten of how difficult it was getting through it. But then the pride came, and I was excited, and I knew that this was a message that needed to be shared. And it's also very uplifting to see that even after so much struggle, that she can pull together, and she has also brought me and my sister up as well as many other family members who struggled through the divorce. So, yes, it's overwhelming pride and joy.
As you said before, you were talking about the hurricane being sort of, we have as a unique people in our attitude to handling hurricanes. Do you think that there's a stigma, a cultural stigma in our country still against being divorced or a divorcee? Or is that not particular to the Bahamas? As someone who is living in the States and now relocating back to the Bahamas, do you feel like in particular you feel in this Christian country, because your book is written from an unapologetically Christian standpoint, you make that clear and you stand in your Christian faith throughout your writing. Is it as something you feel stigmatized to say you're a divorced woman? Do you find it difficult to find support as a Christian divorcee? Or do you think that is not culturally specific?
I think we have to realize that in some of our churches, especially the Catholic Church, which we have a lot of beloved family members are a part of, divorce is still extremely taboo. The Orthodox Church recognizes divorce and has a process of ecclesiastical divorce, but it's still, you talk to some of our older members and they're like, oh, our church doesn't allow divorce. And the fact that you could have a barrier between you and your church community that is put there and that you can't do anything about because something may have happened that was beyond your control, I think that's a very large challenge. And I have to say, one of the things that struck me the hardest was I remember relocating to the Bahamas, working, but also receiving some child support, and going into a bank to get a credit card, which is a very basic tool of life in this day and age, and basically being told that I could not put my child support down as a form of income because it wasn't considered stable income, even though my child support had been stable. I didn't understand why I was more vulnerable as a client than somebody who was in a job that if you got fired from your job, suddenly that income would cease. Mm-hmm. There's also, like, our names matter to us. I had the dilemma of, do I keep the name that my children had? Do I change it? Are you going by Miss or Mrs. or... this awkwardness, a man doesn't have to worry about that. A man keeps his name, he's a mister, whatever happens. That's an awkwardness that I had to grapple with. And I don't know that it's so much a stigma as you're walking into a room as a single person when you were part of a team. You are attending a wedding and you're put at a singles table with the yes. youngins rather than with your married friends. There are things that play out. And for those of us who have children, there's that awkwardness of what happens when there's Father's Day or Mother's Day at school and your child doesn't have that parent in their lives. And that sort of awkwardness that... I think those were the moments when it really came out and hit us. I don't know how Maria felt about.
And you touched on the financial ramifications of divorce because people have said, you know, divorce is a privilege. If you're in the position that you can afford to be divorced, if you can afford to be cut loose, so to speak, then lucky you. Because in the last few months, we've talked to, you know, Superintendent Inspector Wims, on the domestic violence unit about how the fear of financially leaving a toxic situation. We've talked about issues like marital rape and whether you stay or whether you go, and had calls saying this is a Christian country. You know, marriage is sacred, but sweethearting is prevalent still. And so the decision to make a divorce, you emphasize in your book, is deeply personal. There's no right time you can say, this is when you go, this is when you leave. There's a process, and you can't dictate it to anyone else or say this is how you do it and when you do it. But you do say, it might have been easier if my husband had been hit by a truck. Now, men don't get upset. What she's saying is, like, when it comes to clear-cut griefs in which we're grieving a death, you said, I would have had immediate sympathetic support of two united families and communities. I would have had the comfort of home, investments, life insurance, and the ritual of mourning the loss of a beloved person and honoring their memory. Instead, in divorce, you have to cope with the loss of a spouse, that grieving process, and the loss of your own identity without the traditional coping mechanisms associated. So can you speak to that?
Yeah, I mean, as Christians, divorce is the antithesis of everything that we work towards. We act in love. We're trying to pull everything together. And a divorce is the symbol that we have split everything apart. And as we know from the story of Solomon, a child that's ripped in half is not a whole child. And so every aspect of life is a struggle. There are people I've talked to, and the one thing I say is, look, divorce is not the easy option. It might be the safer one, it might be the one you have to take, or it might be, in many circumstances, the one that happened to you that you didn't have control of. But a lot of couples I know struggle through things and do stay together because of the financial ramifications, and that way they manage to keep a whole home for their children and give them the best situations that they can. And I applaud them. I would never say that divorce is the easy answer. It's just every situation is different. Often people ask me, well, how do you know, whether it's time to stay or go? And I don't have that answer. They have to be at peace. The only thing that I could say is that you have to look at your children, you have to look at your loved ones, and you have to say, if they were in the situation facing the decision that you were facing, what would you want them to do? Because I think sometimes we're more protective of our children than we are of ourselves.
And as you say, there's no clearly delineated path in your book. There's no signpost. You actually call it off-roading with Jesus.
Yes.
The fact that you find you felt that you clung more to God in these circumstances because you needed them more. But also you said, in the wake of so much destruction and heartache, which seems unending, you ask, how can we begin to grapple with the intrinsically Christian concepts of forgiveness, healing, communion, and love? But also, how on earth could we expect that healing for a Christian to happen without the tools of the church and without the support of the church? You write, and I thought this was beautiful, you do not have to be perfect to experience God's grace. In your foreword written by the prestigious professor and father, John Chrysavice, he said that he found most touching that you mention kintsukuroi. I don't know if I said that right. Forgive me, my Japanese friends. The Japanese art of mending broken pottery with gold, rendering the end product more beautiful than the original. Now, you do not romanticize divorce. We watch a lot of these Netflix shows, and it's like, yes, I'm divorced. I'm moving to Italy with my little income, and I'm redoing a house in Tuscany. I'm like, that's awesome. Did you pay BPL? But you're saying divorce is not a fresh start. At most, it's the hope of attaining a healthier life by taking a different path. And you say you're not a toddler at the end of divorce, a toddler meaning that you're learning to walk again. You're a war veteran that has a severed limb. You're recovering from a trauma, and that it's not, you're not looking at this with rosy glasses and saying, well, that was good and healthy and off I go skipping into the sunset. But again, that's a lot of these, I had to laugh out loud when you say, I think we've done well if we manage to survive a divorce without spending time in a mental or criminal institution.
Definitely.
I think that also, if we can you speak a little to that? The fact that it's not to be romanticized. Okay, great, fresh start, new me.
It wasn't a fresh start by any means. It was hard, long days when I remember hitting the weekends at times when all I wanted to do was lie on the floor and drool while my kids were playing around me. There was no energy. even getting to church was more of an ordeal than I could handle. And you're often reinventing yourself, finding a new job. I had to start from scratch with a new career. And I mean, the time and the stress. Now, it's also everything that you thought you were going to be able to offer your children, you realize there's now consequences, that rather than have the life and the savings and the maybe the education that you hoped they would have, you're having to deal with children that are wounded and crying and upset and not understanding and needing counseling. So there's a great shift in mentality, and every step is hard. I mean, I remember thinking, like, in the beginning, it's like you hurt all the time. Then you get through a day and there's moments when you're not hurting. Then eventually, just every once in a while, there's a trigger that really sucker punches you. And finally, and this could take years, you feel like it's normal. But I mean, the strength that it can take just to read a text message or an email from someone that you were so close to, the person who knows all of your intimate secrets and weaknesses, who is now not on your side anymore, that is... You know, you have to pull from a deeper inner strength not to end up with a brick in your hand wanting to smash a window.
And I know there's people listening who leave truly dangerous and violent situations and have to flee from a marriage because their life and limb are in question. And so, again, there's different situations that lead to this. But as you sit here, nobody wants to be, and this is, I think, the problem with the, sometimes the problem with the Christian church, I say, as a Christian, everybody, that you don't want to be lectured to by Mary Poppins about someone who hasn't been through something. And often in our churches, we, you know, in the Orthodox Church, you'll come across a lot of celibate leaders or people that don't have the same experiences that are in charge of your spiritual counsel. I find the friendship, the spiritual sisterhood available in these conversations useful, because there's maybe not answers, but there's solidarity. Again, going back to the difficulty of dealing with this ambiguous grief, I was just on a Women's United call with the lovely and wonderful Dr. Michelle Major, who we know has helped lots of families with young people in our country, and we were talking about the issue of suicide. We have seen this in our papers recently. We'll see it in the days to come. And just it came up in the conversation that at times people would rather say they were diagnosed with cancer than to say they had depression or anxiety or thoughts of suicide. You've said in your book you even understood the elements when people do cutting, when they cut themselves with razors. That happens a lot with our teenagers who are suffering with depression, because it's an external sign of an internal hurt. It's something that's saying, look, this is happening. This is what we're going through. As we throughout the show, we talk about, you know, the issues within the family, the fact that I think three shows I've been on lately, it's always come up, you know, that single mothering is what's not contributing, but is the lack of support of single mothers in the home is leading to this criminal element. Again, it's the difficulty of dealing with the gray areas of this grief, I think, make it important for people to find friendship within this subject. What do you think?
Sorry, there was a lot in there.
I know, that was. But C.A. Neri would beat me for that question. That wasn't a question. That was amusing, as this is an unclear grief. Now, as you said, this is not a someone has died, mourn them. This is a life that has gone, rebuilded.
Yeah, it's a life that's rebuilding. And it's very hard to make new relationships or even pick up with old ones, because you know, what are you going to do, walk into church and in fellowship time see someone that you haven't seen in a while, and they're like, so how are you doing, and what's up? And suddenly you have to tell them, if you're going to have a meaningful interaction, about the hurricane that has hit your life, and knowing that you're going to inflict horror on them, or the embarrassment of meeting a new acquaintance and having to explain what a mess you feel your life is. Those it's very hard to reach out to form new friendships, to maintain old ones. And also, you're very emotionally needy at that time. It's hard for those who are even trying to support you to be there all the time and helping you. And I think we also, one of our problems is that we all walk into church on Sunday looking our best, smiling, and it's not necessarily a superficial thing. Even if you're going through trauma, being at church can be a very positive, uplifting time, and you may not feel as bad as you would through the rest of the week. But as we look at around our churches, we often see everyone looks good, everyone's smiling. We see their social media posts, and everyone looks like they have it together. And we don't actually know what crosses each person is carrying. And if we don't have real conversations, if we don't get beyond, hi, how are you doing? Oh, I'm great. Then we can't truly be a support for each other.
You talk about community a lot throughout your book and the importance of community. And you say you get married within a community, with a community, and therefore you get divorced with a community and within a community. So therefore, these coming togethers and separations can have generational impacts. Going back to my friend Gia Pierre's Crazy Love series, it focuses on the torment, the agony, the ecstasy of these romantic relationships that can be diminished and trivialized when we're doing our external talking, but truly contributes to most of our emotional and mental well-being. No normal Bahamian has enough money right now. Nobody can truly walk into food stores or pay bills without wincing right now. So, but to have a stable home life is what is usually keeps you sane and nonviolent. It takes the emotional brick out of your hand. And so when you're struggling emotionally, that can be the great destabilizer. Where do we, in the Bahamas, and if anyone is on the brink about calling, call in. Tell us your thoughts. One of the things we keep getting is, one of my texts coming through is about the causes of divorce and why did it happen and how did it happen? You actually, at the beginning of your book, talk about why you don't think that's necessarily the most important question. Why do you think the cause is not necessarily the most important question?
That wasn't the focus of the book, simply because there are so many different things that lead to divorce. And everyone has a different journey, a different path. A lot of time, very well-meaning people would ask me, well, what do you think led to it? Because, you know, we don't want to run into the same problems with our own marriages. And, you know, did you not give your husband enough attention? Did you have financial issues? Did you not have a good enough routine? And they were like searching for the answers so that they could comfort themselves that they weren't vulnerable to the same reality that I ended up with. But the truth is that when it comes to ministry, focusing on what caused it is a bit like focusing on someone who's been through a car accident. And the point is that you can go in and say, well, what caused the car accident? Were you drunk? Were you tired? Did somebody hit you? Or you can go and have a conversation and say, you know, how are you feeling? Are you hurt? Do you need physical therapy? Do you need food? You know, what can we do to get you back to a healthier place? It's not that it's not important to reflect on what caused a car accident so that it doesn't happen again, but we miss out on a very important form of ministry when people feel like they almost have to validate their worth and the fact that they weren't at blame for where they ended up in a divorce before we can start to offer them support, comfort, healing.
We have a few texts. One of them says, great show as usual. The cause is important. Sometimes it's self-inflicted. And finances play a serious part. If you go broke, your wife conned about too much. I think everyone knows that. I mean, I remember before I married my husband, I'm like, let's be honest about finances, because this is the number one thing that causes pressure. And again, our four-year anniversary to this month of COVID, nobody is flush. No, nobody is rolling in more money than they need to do with. And also in the Bahamas, we don't date. Am I going to get in trouble from IRCA? We do something else. And then we find out the person's name, and then we're dumb enough to get married after meeting them for 6 months. I think these are pointing to text, and I'll tell you why in a minute. And they say, great show as usual. I think people get divorced now because one, people get married for the wrong reasons, and then basically goes on to say, and then a woman finds money. So there's leading to financial security. But what I think is important with these texts is we're getting married without the correct information in place, without the correct behaviors and knowledge in place. place. And I would say from a Christian point of view, people will say there's two things that do not have guideposts. One is dating and the other is divorce. It doesn't say there is not a step-by-step in the Bible. Now, there will be arguments back and forth about looking for your Rebeccas, but there's not a step-by-step in the Bible exactly how to date and exactly how to get divorced. And the church cannot ostracize people in either of these situations. So again, you've said, with the experience I have and with the wisdom I've lived with, here are some things I have found, a 101 list of what works for me at this time. Maria, I just want to say that you're mentioned in the book often as a child of divorce, who is alive and kicking and shining brightly. But you did a high school project at some point interviewing your friends about whose lives were affected by divorce. What did you find doing that?
I was actually, at first I was nervous because I couldn't think of anybody to reach out to. And I asked my teacher, like, can I interview myself? Like, can I use myself as an example? She said, yes. But then I started reaching out and I didn't have to use myself because I found my sister, obviously. I found my cousins. I found school friends and teachers and everybody else who were also victims of divorce.
So as we say, it's generational, it's widespread. There's nobody listening today that doesn't have a sister, mother, friend, brother, teacher going through divorce. We're going to go to a quick break. When we come back, I hope that people will call in with their thoughts on this matter. And we appreciate you for being here with us today on Guardian Radio Book Club.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Did you know the bacteria that causes TB can live in your body without making you sick? This is called latent TB infection. People with strong immune systems can live with no symptoms of TB, have a normal chest x-ray, and not infect others. However, if the immune system becomes weakened, then latent TB may turn into active TB and can make you and the people around you very sick. If you or someone you know begins to experience coughing that lasts 3 weeks or longer, coughing up blood, weight loss, night sweats, pain in the chest, weakness or tiredness, chills or fever, contact your healthcare provider or the Ministry of Health's Tuberculosis Surveillance Unit at 502-4728 or 502-4803 immediately. These are signs that latent TB may have become active TB. Tuberculosis is preventable and curable. The clock is ticking. Let's end TB.
This message brought to you by the Ministry of Health and Wellness and this Stay
Friday, April 5th. Get ready for another exciting Fish Fry Friday. We got to sleep. We got to rest. At Margaritaville, downtown Nassau. Featuring the big band Visage and DJ Beats with the latest in soca, bohemian, and old school jams. Everybody take
a drop. Come to party, I like y'all. Don't want no man.
$25 general admission, $55 buffet and party.
Doors open at 6:30 p.m. Party until 11:30 p.m. That's April 5th, Fish Fry Friday. The stage has been moved, so you've got more dancing space.
Fish Fry Friday, April 5th. At Margaritaville, downtown Nassau.
Parking at the point for only $10. See you at Fish Fry Friday, April 5th, with the big band Vistage.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Morning and welcome back to Guardian AM. I'm Catherine Chisnell Mitchell, and I'm here in the studio with Callie Opie, Kushel Wilson. She's my sister. I should know her name. And Maria Kushel, her daughter, her niece. We're talking about her newly published first book, Weathering the Hurricane of Divorce, Reflection of a Survivor. I would like to say thank you to the rest of Calliope's family today, not just myself included. The entail of this is that Calliope has remarried a wonderful man called Jim, our Guyanese-Canadian import. We love him very much. She has two beautiful daughters, Maria and Diana, graduates of Queen's College, who are thriving, one off to college and one college bound. But again, acknowledges throughout the story that not everything necessarily has this happen. predetermined happy ending. Not everyone finds that person that is going to be the next match for them. Sometimes struggle seems unending and without light at the end of the tunnel. Again, you refer to your relationship with God and your Christian faith, and that finding God a light in dark places when all other lights go out. Where's that quote from? Was that
it's
Tolkien?
Tolkien. Lord of the Rings.
And that you have found, you cover a lot of big subjects throughout the book, which I encourage you to go out and give a try to support a Bahamian author. And also, if you're dealing with any kind of loss, this is something that can be there as a balm for it. You talk about forgiveness as a gift, not a burden. You talk about rage and your decision not to unleash the pain mirrored in you. And you talk about parenting, not becoming a single parent, but becoming a double parent throughout the journeys of your divorce. But with all of this aside, you also give a very, and this is one thing I love when I'm reading something that I want to help me out in a book. You give a 101 guide of some coping tips or tools. You're like, this is not going to solve everything, but these are some things that helped me. I'd love you to touch a little bit on that.
Well, coming out of college and also moving away from family, I got hit. We also, I think, lost about 3 family members in 1 year to death.
Yes.
And it was a very emotionally exhausting time. And I was definitely, I just couldn't stop crying. This was back when I was in my young 20s. I was definitely dealing with things. And I figured I was in a spiritual crisis. I went into my priest with my box of tissues and poured out my soul and thought that, you know, I would just go to confession and then I'd feel better. And I had a wonderful, wonderful priest who listened to me and then said, I think you might be suffering from clinical depression. And he referred me to another very Christian doctor who was lovely. They gave me a whole guideline to a more healthier living, because we all know post high school college life is not
your healthiest necessarily, unless you're one of our Bahamian athletes, in which case stay healthy. We applaud you.
Exactly.
We need you healthy.
Exactly. But and those coping mechanisms that I learned and developed and incorporated into my life, they definitely helped through whatever other challenge we came, whether it was losing other family members, whether it was dealing with sickness or financial crisis, and eventually divorce. And so it seems very basic, but things such as there's tools of our faith and tools of just healthy living that when you're in the middle of the hurricane, you can forget. And to literally have a checklist to work your way through can be a great help. Like in the Orthodox Christian tradition, there is what we call the Jesus Prayer. It's literally, Lord, have mercy on me.
Lord Jesus Christ, yes, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner.
There you go. He shows that I am nervous. But using that prayer just as a screensaver when you're in the midst of a
storm. A mental screensaver.
Yes, exactly. When you just don't know what else to say, don't know what else to do, have somebody verbally or physically attacking you, and you're just trying not to add to the heat of the fire. Things like that. That's a huge thing. Journaling. And when journaling to me sounds a bit artistic, but writing things down rather than speaking them and putting them on paper. I made lists. I made the list of pros and cons as to whether, do I go here? Do I do this? Just gratitude lists too. Sometimes you just have to count your blessings when you're in the midst of that moment of craziness. Actually count what you still can be grateful for. And also, there's not everyone in our lives, as much as they love us, can handle hearing all of the pain all the time. And so to put it down on paper rather than burdening our loved ones with it is sometimes a very important tool.
Yeah. And you have a chapter on the Lighthouse Keepers in which you do say sometimes you need someone close and trusted to you to say something that's obvious, because you can't see. You are blind. There are blind spots. And I think when any of us have stress, we can sometimes lose sight of the path in front of us.
And, and even that comes even sometimes from forgiveness, that we just cannot forgive ourselves and let go. And sometimes we need someone who is spiritually mature to say, you've done your best, move on. And that can give a great sense of peace that we can't necessarily release that completely by ourselves. And then there's basic things. Taking a multivitamin, going for a walk a few times a week. Now, that might not be easy with young children.
Endorphins.
Endorphins are important. We're physical beings as well as spiritual. And if you have to make sure you eat. You have to make sure you get regular sleep. Don't overdo the alcohol or the sugar or the pain meds.
You have a quote in your book about that when you talk about depression. You say, we're not purely spiritual beings like angels. When our bodies hurt, so do our spirits. Yes. When our spirits hurt, so do our souls. They're inseparable, which is why, you know, I'm always encouraged by our little Bahamian athletics when I see them, because they are antidepressants to our culture with their movement and health. But that's a good point.
Yeah, and I would just say the end is that I'd like to sort of wrap up with is that we have to be kind on ourselves, in that remembering that life is not about getting everything perfect the first time around. It's about we're going to stumble, we're going to fall. It's standing up, trying again, keep marching on, and it's the end of the road that's important, and to keep going in that direction.
I want to re-quote you when you say you do not need, when you talk about gratitude and perspective, you say you do not need to be perfect to experience God's grace. The desire to create beauty and worth out of that which is broken and worn, and to see the blows of life as essential to the process of salvation, then in suffering you find meaning and value. I won't say the cutest, because it sounds like I'm talking down to you. One of the cutest coping mechanisms I think you have is your self-declared art therapy, in which Callie is the original hoarder, okay? Now, this is a Bahamian problem. We see a glass jar, we're like, we can't throw that away, right, Gigi Turnquest? We have to hold on to these. We might have a pandemic. We might have a hurricane. We might need those super value thousands of plastic bags. And guess what, guys? We did. We needed those, because we don't have plastic bags anymore, and I still have a little secret stash. So that the fact that using what we have and to create something beautiful for God, Dostoevsky said that beauty will save the world. And I think you finding beauty in that which is broken is seen throughout the course of your book. It is not romanticized. It is not a Hallmark fairy tale, but it does say that there are paths. God has always prepared paths forward for us. We just have to find the courage, the wisdom, the way to take them. And sometimes they're taken with a great deal of companionship. And you do thank those people throughout your book. I'm totally biased as a sister, but also I'm happy to see that our Bahamian authors are being courageous enough to delve into so many things in life. The mental health of our country is essential to us marching on. Yes, Gia Pierre, I'm dropping your plate everywhere I can. To marching on as a country, to having a vision going forward, to seeing past the blind spots of the clouds of darkness, despair, financial and emotional, spiritual, marital burdens that may bog us down at this moment, and saying that there's the light at the end of the tunnel, maybe not a train, but a light, a hope coming forward. Maria, anything you want to say to wrap up as the young, bright light in our studio that I think is, I don't want to be like this is a success story, but she's alive, everybody. She's bathed. Her hair's washed. She's a functioning adult, and she was a child that came from a traumatic divorce situation into the bosom of her Bahamian school, church, and actual family. But you're a survivor, too. What do you have to say?
I have to say that if anything taught me about growing up this way, of going through divorce, of surviving it, is that it's shown me how much of a community that I have. And I have to say that also growing up in the Bahamas changed my life completely in one of the best ways possible. It's actually driven me to design college, to pursue a profession that will bring me back so that I can better my country with whatever skills I gain. But at the same time, I also know that life, this is not the happy fairy tale ending. Life is going to keep going. There's going to be more hurricanes. But I know that I have my mother, I have my auntie, I have my family, and I know that we're going to make it through.
And just to exhaust the poetry of the metaphor, I will say that we continue to live in this God-blessed, beautiful land, knowing that a hurricane will come, knowing that we will have devastation again upon us, and yet we live, and yet we stand in these sands with our toes in the salty seas, with the sun on our back, because we choose this life despite the destruction and the hardship, because we love this. And that's what I say about entering into marriage or choosing to continue after divorce. We're choosing to carry on with the sun on our back. I would like to say that this book, Weathering the Hurricane of Divorce, Reflections as a Survivor of a Survivor by Calliope Cushell Wilson, is available on Amazon. It is available at Logos Bookstore and at Bahamas Handicrafts on Shirley Street.
And at Tanya Saunders Boutique.
You feel free to reach out to the author on Facebook. She has a Facebook page under the title, Weathering weathering the hurricane of divorce. And for all of those who are experiencing heartache and turmoil and the darkness, I've been there, I think, and my sister's been there. I think most of us in life at some point have looked up and not been able to see out. Please feel the hope and light that is that a journey ahead is possible, that a new path is possible. Callie, you wanted to say something to wrap up?
Yeah, and I'm going to throw Maria under the bus a bit, but, you know, just to understand, like, at grade two, because she pretty much missed grade one with the divorce, she could not read. She did not even want to step into a classroom. I remember my beloved Sylvia Benaby, the headmistress of Queen's College, literally wrapping her in a bear hug as she was hysterical, and I was trying to drop her off at a classroom and saying, she'll be okay.
We love you, Mrs. Benaby.
And we went through the hard work, but we got there. So it's not that this was always smooth and perfect. No. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I just have to close out with one text that is a perfect ending to the show. She looks good and she divorced. Boy, he lose out. You do look good, Callie. Everyone says we look like twins. I would like to again thank Guardian Radio and C.A. Nuri for allowing us this opportunity for mentoring women. I'll say us young, beautiful women so well. This is why we're on radio, so you can't prove me wrong. And supporting Bahamian literature. He's an author himself, and I can't wait to interview him on his writing on one of our Bahamian Book Club Fridays coming up in the future. Thank you all for being here, and have a wonderful weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you.